Let me begin to thank by to begin by thanking Amanda Anderson for her kind, generous invitation to be a participant among this year's School of Criticism and Theory. It has been a wonderful experience, very rewarding, and I suspect that this week, for obvious reasons, if I can start talking without moving this thing all too much, will be even more rewarding. Without much, okay. Okay. I've never been this wired in my life. Okay. Okay, without much further ado, let me begin. Arguably, no recent text has done more to spawn interest in the so-called Weimar moment in political theology and generally the rhetoric of religion in Germany in the period spanning the two world wars than Jakob Taubes's Die politische Theologie des Paulus, The Political Theology of Paul. The transcript of his 1987 seminar at the FEST, the Forschungsstätte der Evangelischen Studiengemeinschaft, which is the Protestant Institute for Interdisciplinary Research in Heidelberg, and a noteworthy testament to his writing and teaching. The transcript of the audio recordings of these lectures were published posthumously in 1993 by Jan and Eileida Assmann, together with Wolf Daniel Hartwig, and marked the beginning of much renewed interest in this controversial thinker. To give an example, Giorgio Agamben salutes Taubes' reading at the very opening of his The Time That Remains, his interpretation of the letter to the Romans. And while other recent philosophical readings of Paul, such as the ones published by Alain Badiou, Stanislas Breton, Bernard Siger, Jean-Michel Rey, and others find their sources of inspiration in different contexts and problems, there is no doubt that Taubes' legacy stands out and that the publication of his seminar anticipated, inspired, and in some cases simply coincided with the turning point in Paul scholarship, undertaken by thinkers not formally trained in or limiting themselves to biblical and systematic, that is, dogmatic, theology per se. At the same moment, no contemporary reading of Paul and his modern interpreters has proven more fraught with ambiguity, sweeping and often quite violent statements, and no small amount of bad faith that this impromptu, improvised, final commentary, not Taubes' first, but his last word on the matter, he gave the seminar as he was dying from cancer, represents. Taubes' switches back and forth between contentious claims about the so-called messianic logic, which was summarized and analyzed, he acknowledges, first of all by Gershom Scholem, my teacher, he says, although the respect was not mutual, especially in his 1938 Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism, the book dedicated to the memory of Walter Benjamin, on the one hand, and a host of hasty, now exuberant, then scathing comments on a whole series of thinkers in critical theory, biblical hermeneutics, philosophy and psychoanalysis on the other, whose name, like Scholem's, are still very much with us. Nietzsche and Freud, Buber and Karl Barth, Adorno and Horkheimer. Yet, amidst these debris and wisecracks that these apodictically formulated lecture notes, beautifully rendered by Dana Hollander in her translation, leave us with, they leave us with genuine insights that can be found among them and that merit and indeed stand in dire need of further and far more systematic commentary and extrapolation. For while Taubes' contribution seems first of all that of a remarkably sharp and deeply personal, at times outright idiosyncratic, not to mention outrageous portrait of a whole generation whose legacy still largely defines the terms of contemporary reflection on the academic and more broadly political turn to religion, capturing our imagination in recent years. It is also clear that much in his thought, in his own observations, suggests a deeper underlying logic, one whose at times extreme rhetoric and messianism, or more precisely apocalyptic, is conceived by Taubes, quote, from the bottom up, and it has lost absolutely nothing of its philosophical, theological, and indeed political relevance. Bringing out some of this logic's guiding themes and overall structure and arguments, understanding the historical context and meaning in which it emerged, was used and abused, while attempting to sound out its conceptual limits so as to intuit what step beyond we ought to take next. No doubt, also in light of contemporary experiences and the new questions these impose, this is the task whose partial fulfillment I have set myself in a larger project of which I can present only a fragment today. And this not only due to my limited time, for it is needless to say that a much broader and sustained execution of such an ambitious agenda requires the joint efforts of intellectual historians and philosophers, specialists in close literary reading, as well as scriptural exegesis. As we will see, Taubes, his main trusted sources, and the contemporaries that irritate him most, all engage in extensive, at times hyperbolic, religious phrasing, more precisely, in a logic of theological exaggeration and exasperation, in which universalizing totalization goes hand in hand with exhaustion, indeed, with a risky apocalyptic va-banque that is, I think, deeply instructive in itself. In any case, it is crucial for our understanding of the philosophical renaissance of interest in Paul at the moment of which a forthcoming book due out this coming October that I co-edited with Ward Blanton documents some notable instances. Not the least captivating aspect of Taubes' work is the way in which it characterized several intellectual constellations in the period that interests me here. I'm thinking, first of all, of his brief portrait of two, quote, zealots of the absolute and of decision, end of quote, namely Carl Schmitt and Karl Barth, perversely put together in one breath with the typical broad gesture and sweeping claim that Taubes masters like no one else, but also of the contrast between, quote, nihilism as world politics and aestheticized messianism, end of quote, epitomized by Walter Benjamin and Theodor Adorno. To be a zealot, Alain Badiou, yet another reader of Paul, might call this a militant. To be a zealot of the absolute and of decision, in its most uncompromising expression, would result, Taubes claims, in nihilism, as a global political maxim, as world politics, that is. And of this, an aestheticized, that is, merely hypostasized, an imagined version would strip messianism of what is left and perhaps always was its weak or weakening force, its schwache Kraft, as Benjamin's thesis on history formulates so suggestively. How could what from a distance seems, well, so distant, here especially the juxtaposition of the names of Schmitt and Barth, have become so entangled and amalgamated in Taubes' latest account? And conversely, how can he separate so violently, for instance, nihilism and aestheticism, Benjamin and Adorno? What no matter how accurate or inaccurate these conceptual attributions and personal characterizations form part of one and the same intellectual configuration, that is, of early Frankfurt School theory or neo-Marxism, no matter how much one dramatizes and spins undeniable tensions and conflicts between its first representatives after the fact. So again, as far as Schmidt and Barth are concerned, are the decisive differences between these thinkers, historically, in their time, and conceptually, that is, theologically speaking, perhaps not so significant as we often like to believe? And as to Benjamin and Adorno, are the differences between them really as big as Taubes claims them to be? To complicate matters even more, do these suggested pairs of similar or distinct thinkers not also cross over into each other, and indeed partially overlap, so that the genealogy of early 20th century German Jewish thought, not least in its reception of Paul's epistles, needs further revision in its silent premises and accepted outcomes still? To give an example of Benjamin, Taubes remarks in passing that his much debated theological political fragment should be understood from the point of view of Karl Barth's second 1922 edition of his commentary on the Römerbrief, the letter to the Romans, the epistle to the Romans, that is, quote, as dialectical theology outside the Christian church, end of quote. That is to say, we should read Benjamin's theological political fragment not so much as, quote, dogmatics and so on, end of quote, but as, quote, dialectical theology of 1920 in its very first phase in lay theologies as a lion theology, end of quote. Taubes praises Benjamin for having, quote, a hardness similar to that of Barth, end of quote. And he adds that just as in the letter's commentary on Paul's epistle to the Romans, so also in the former's theological political fragment, there is, strictly speaking, nothing there having to do with immanence. From that, one gets nowhere. The drawbridge comes from the other side, and whether you get fetched or not, as Kafka describes it, is not up to you. One can take the elevator up to the high rises of spirituality, it won't help. Hence, the clear break. You can't get anything out of it. You have to be told from the other side that you're liberated, end of quote. Adorno, on the contrary, in these final notes, is merely ridiculed for having treated redemption as a, quote, comme si affaire, end of quote. That is to say, as a fictionalist aesthetic, as if, als ob, as a matter that one can hypothesize about, but that doesn't lead further. This is not to say that Adorno, on Taubes' reading, thinks of redemption in terms of a religious a priori, as the neo-Kantians, such as Hermann Cohen, and most notably Hans Feyinger, had proposed. Rather, Taubes sees in Adorno's, in his eyes, dubious. Taubes sees in Adorno an, in his eyes, dubious and hesitant stance of a mere softening and flattening out of the more daring and authoritative, not to mention authoritarian, Benjamin. And he suggests of Pauline and Barthian perspectives, and one that results in a wrongly headed, aestheticized messianism of sorts. Paul's invocation in the first letter to the Corinthians of the so-called hos me, als ob nicht, the as if not, indeed the adjunction to have one's possessions and place in the world as if one does precisely not have them, is, Taubes assumes, a fundamentally nihilistic operation. It is a New Testament invocation that will find one of its strongest echoes in the second century, figure of the excommunicated bishop Marcion of Sinope, especially his Gospel of the Alien God, as Adolf von Harnack had documented in his 1921 study with the same title, Marcion, das Evangelium vom fremden Gott. A book which had cited and reconstructed words from Marcion's lost work, The Antitheses, as follows. This is the cover of the book that actually Benjamin studied in much detail, namely Adolf von Harnack's three-volume voluminous Lehrbuch der Dogmengeschichte, The History of Dogma. And this is the first thesis that Harnack devoted to Marcion. And this is what we know of Marcion. So Taubes cites this from Harnack's work. O wonder of all wonders, wunder aller wunder, that in spite of this world, there is redemption. And in a slightly different wording, a few pages later in the text, Taubes puts every emphasis on what he calls Marcion's very first sentence in the book that we don't have, but that is reconstructed by Harnack out of various sources. Here, the gospel is understood as gift and is introduced as follows. O wonder upon wonder, wunder über wunder. What amazement and overpowering astonishment it is that people who have nothing, who have not a thing to say about the gospel, that they do not think about it, nor that it can be compared with anything at all. That is certainly not with anything of this world. It is alien, das Fremde, the alien God, an expression of Marcion's Deus Alienus, meets with something equally alien in us. End of quote. Now, to say this is not to claim that Marcion follows Paul or that Paul anticipates Marcion on all counts. Taubes's claim and Taubes's aim is far more limited here and revolves around the question of a certain messianic and more specifically apocalyptic or nihilistic logic, presumably shared by both early Christian authors, Paul and Marcion. It's not a question of showing pedantically where Marcion diverges from Paul. That is easily done. The fact, right, that Marcion rejected the Hebrew scripture and its God as inferior, as the non-loving creator God, whereas Paul obviously did not, being the clearest difference between the two. The question, Taubes goes on, is where does he, Marcion, capture an intention? Where does Marcion capture Paul's intention? End of quote. In one word, how is it that Marcion could take himself to be Paul's true disciple? And what explains that others so easily took his word for the truth? Indeed, von Harnack's opening salvo in his monograph and in the earlier prize-winning essay or Preisschrift, which I showed earlier, of which it offered a further elaboration many years later, is telling because it places Marcion, in Harnack's own words, quote, his very first love in church history, in the role of the, quote, most significant phenomenon in church history between Paul and Augustine, right? And that's no small matter. As Harnack formulated himself, Marcion, and this is from the preface about the alien God, of the book about the alien God, Marcion affords us the key for unlocking a number of the difficult problems that are presented by the tradition, the transition of the church from the post-apostolic to the old Catholic period. Here, one can dismiss every individual Gnostic without loss, but we cannot omit Marcion. If we wish to understand the dynamic development, indeed the metamorphosis that occurs in the time of that transition. Not only because Catholicism is constructed as a defense against Marcion, but in a still higher degree because it appropriated from this heretic something fundamental. Still greater is Marcion's hitherto sadly neglected significance in the general history of religion, for he is the only thinker in Christianity who took fully seriously the conviction that the deity who redeems one from the world has absolutely nothing to do with cosmology and with cosmic theology. The new life of faith and freedom was for him something so alien as over against the world that he based its emergence upon the same doubtful or daring hypothesis by which Helmholtz proposed to explain the emergence of organism on the earth. End of quote. The claim would seem to anticipate a later and indeed deeply Augustinian claim by the political philosopher Hannah Arendt in her essay, What is Freedom?, in the book Between Past and Future, that there is a striking resemblance between miracles which capture or name the very possibility for human agency, for human beginning, the divine birth of beginning, as Arendt puts it in The Human Condition, and the, quote, infinite improbabilities of the genesis of cosmic formations, organic and eventually intelligent life that make up our universe. It is, by the way, a conception that, if I'm not mistaken, Quentin Meillassoux adopts almost verbatim in the few published fragments that we have of his major work, L'inexistence divine, Essai sur le Dieu virtuel, right? The inexistence of God, or the divine inexistence, an essay about the virtual God, albeit without reference to Arendt, to my knowledge. But then, of course, Arendt follows the Gospels rather than Paul's letters, and Meillassoux ignores, or in any case fails to reference, both. Taubes takes von Harnack's intuition yet a step further, bluntly noting that, quote, creation has no role in the New Testament, end of quote, and adding that on the contrary, there is, quote, only one thing there, redemption, or more carefully put, that the thread that links creation and redemption is a very thin one, a very, very thin one, and it can snap, and that's Marcion. He finds an echo, another echo, in Benjamin's adoption of a radically Pauline notion of creation, a notion that emphasizes the, quote, labor pains and futility, end of quote, of creation, as announced in Roman 8, quote, the groaning of the creature, the idea of creation as decay, since it is without hope. Indeed, Taubes writes, I see Benjamin, quote, as the exegete of the nature of Romans 8, of decay, and of Romans 13, of nihilism as world politics, end of quote. In this respect, then, as Taubes' characterization of Benjamin in an essay, Ein moderner Marcionit, a modern Marcionite, makes abundantly clear, this Marxist messianistic, or this Marxist messianic, or messianic Marxist author's theological political view resembles not just this most formidable among all Christian heretics, as read by Adolf von Harnack, but it also echoes and resonates with early 20th century attempts to situate the Pauline corpus, and notably Paul's epistle to the Romans, squarely within the context of Jewish messianism, in all of its apocalyptic and theocratic, dialectic, as well as revolutionary democratic aspects. For in different ways, starting out from distinct premises and with an alternative, ulterior, theoretical, and practical aim in mind, This much had also been intimated by a variety of thinkers, such as Martin Buber and Ernst Bloch, Theodor Adorno, and at a greater distance, as we will see, Max Horkheimer, but also Erich Auerbach and Hans-Joachim Schöps, Carl Schmitt, and we found Jakob Taubes. We do not know whether Benjamin was familiar with Harnack's writings on Marcion, but we have a source for the fact that in the spring of 1918, he was immersed in the reading of Harnack's three-volume work, the Lehrbuch der Dogmengeschichte, the History of Dogma. And lest we forget, Benjamin at the time was deeply steeped in the reading of Martin Heidegger as well, in whose, quote, nihilism, Taubes' wife, the later wife, Susanna Anima Taubes, would detect Gnostic foundations in an interesting and well-researched article that in the end perhaps does not fully convince, but that captures something of the spirit of the times in which Sein und Zeit was received and categorized. On Taubes' account then, against the background of modern Marcionism, the only way out of the predicament of both nature and empire, of creation and what we might call second nature, the second nature of the social, cultural, normal, and normative order as a whole, the only way out would be nothing short of a wager or miracle, a terrifying gamble and throw of the dice, the fatality of divine providence and predetermination, no less than a stroke of good luck, denying and defying scientific laws and the logics of probability, and untying the age-old knot between determining causes and their proportionate effects. But with a remarkable reversal of Albert Einstein's well-known dictum, God doesn't play dice, Taubes also inscribes a necessary contingency in the very heart of the divine. In the God of love, the other or alien God, who, unjustifiably by any standard, just so chooses or elects to acknowledge only some, while avoiding, that is, affronting and perhaps immobilizing most others. God, Paul's God, Taubes writes, plays dice. He elects and condemns. In the Calvinist form, this is a game of dice. One is born to election and born to damnation. And we, just as the pot cannot ask the potter, can't ask why he created us in this way. The stakes are high then. And Taubes writes, it's a different matter whether one decides in whatever way to understand the cosmos as immanent and governed by laws, or whether one thinks the miracle is possible, the exception. The question is whether you think the exception is possible. And it is on the exception, after all, that the whole law of natural science runs aground, because natural science is based on prognosis. By contrast, the wager, the miracle, the divine throw of the dice escapes our very understanding and experience of causality and finality, probability and randomness, relation and correlation, the analogy of being, the analogia entis, and perhaps even the analogy of faith, the analogia fidei. In fact, there's nothing quite like it. Its effect is special in the most emphatic, paradoxical, and apparatic of ways. Put differently, the concept and metaphor of the miracle stands here not only for the fact that God and faith, that is, the Messiah's arrival, resurrection, and all the rest, condemn and shipwreck not just the premises and organizing concepts of natural and dogmatic theology, indeed of all traditional metaphysics and the ontology that has been built upon it, but also modern historicism, psychologism, and everything we might now call culturalism and lingualism, scientism and cognitivism. It limits, strictly speaking, their possibility by imposing suggesting an impossible possibility. And similarly, challenges thereby the presumed consistency of every more genuinely biblical and ecclesial, dogmatic or mystical theology and theocracy that deserves its name. Not even the so-called critically realist, crisis-oriented, dialectical theology finds a way out, but at least knows that it stands condemned and assumes the negative, the nullity of its all-too-firm affirmations, including that of the positivity, let alone the positivism, of its concept of revelation, its so-called Offenbarungspositivismus, with which Karl Barth often was associated. As Karl Barth, following Harnack, notes in the preface to the second edition of his The Epistle to the Romans, Paulinism has always stood on the brink of heresy. And yet we should, he writes, Karl Barth, quite famous in his days, we should reflect whether the persistent covering up of the dangerous element in Christianity is not to hide its light under a bushel. Perhaps Oswald Spengler was right when he told us that we are entering upon an iron age, ein eisernes Zeitalter. If this be so, theology and the theologians are bound to bear the marks of it. End of quote. What then is the dangerous element, and how does Barth succeed in keeping some of its strongest and most suggestive historical and contemporary interpretations, such as those proposed by Marcion, initiator of the early church's greatest challenge, as read by von Harnack, or by the radical reformer Thomas Münzer, instigator of the bloody farmers' revolts, as he would eventually would come to be read by Ernst Bloch. How does he keep these heretical tendency in Paul at bay, as he had to do, and as he stated, was also his explicit intention? After all, it was with both of these figures, Marcion and Thomas Münzer, with whom the author of the theological commentary, the Epistle to the Romans, already in his first and far less radical first edition, was quickly compared by detractors and sympathizers alike. And Barth comments on this in the preface to the second edition, the most influential one. Harnack's book on Marcion appeared while I was immersed in the writing of my commentary. Those who are familiar with both books will understand why I am bound to refer to it. I was puzzled on reading the earlier review of Harnack's book by the remarkable parallels between what Marcion had said and what I was actually writing. I wish to plead for a careful examination of these agreements before I be praised or blamed hastily, as though I were a Marcionite. At the crucial points, these agreements break down. End of quote. What then are these crucial points in which Barth's Paul and Harnack's Marcion seem to converge, intersect, overlap, in any case, to touch upon each other, tangentially as it were, if only to depart in altogether different directions, as the apparent agreement also breaks down? No doubt, it is the reference to the, quote, nothing, the nichts, to which the New Testament Gospels and a fortiori Paul's letters reduce the powers that be, whether the power of nature and the cosmos, of the political and of empire, of the flesh and of sin, in short, the very order of fallen creation, or of the creator God, as Harnack's Marcion had gone even further to suggest. All of which is exposed on Barth's reading to a crisis. And the dialectical theology, as Barth formulates it in these early commentaries, is a theology of crisis, if nothing else. No doubt it is also the insistence on the paradoxical nature of the redemption in Christ and nowhere else for Barth, affecting yet a further crisis in Christianity that in Marcion's case, in the years 150-190 of the Christian era, as Harnack had reconstructed them, is that is the most simple, important event between the conversion of Paul, narrated in Acts, and the confession of Augustine, as recounted in the letters book with the same title. But it also resembles that of a Luther, even though it constituted a far more significant and deeply consequential challenge of the church than the one represented by the Reformation, whether Luther's, Calvin's, or Münster's, for that matter. Already in his early dissertation, von Harnack had identified Marcion as the, quote, modern believer of the second century, the first reformer, end of quote. Indeed, as a, quote, radical modernist, end of quote, whose present actuality could be found in the widely felt need to refuse both syncretism and compromise. It is no accident, therefore, that Marcionite elements have been detected in modernist authors. In addition to the ones that I mentioned earlier, there is Charles Baudelaire, who has elements of Marcionism in Les Fleurs du Mal. There's Thomas Mann in his Dr. Faustus, who makes several arguments in the Marcionite tradition. You might mention Paul Celan and Samuel Beckett, who have been cited in this particular context as well. This said, the difference between von Harnack's and Barth's view of Marcion's place and significance in the history of the church is mirrored in the unbridgeable distance between Harnack's and Barth's respective conceptions of the essence of Christianity, and more importantly, of the task of Religionswissenschaft, the science of religion, steeped in the 19th century conception of liberal culture Protestantism, Kulturprotestantismus, that bore von Harnack's signature, and so-called dogmatic biblical theology, the eventually critical realistic kirchliche Dogmatik, or church dogmatics, that would become Barth's resolutely radical response to it. The fundamental contrast between the two defining projects in Protestant theology became publicly manifest with the official break between the two when von Harnack, like most of the revered teachers of Barth's generation, sided with the belligerent policies of the emperor, Kaiser Wilhelm II, at the outbreak of the First World War, provoking the need for a new start and a new reorientation. On Taubes's account, Barth's dialectical theology, then, is a modern expression of the so-called messianic logic. That is to say, of the view that the internal logic of events, in Barth's days no less than in our days and in Paul's, requires, quote, a faith that is paradoxical, that is contradicted by the evidence. A faith that is paradoxical, contradicted by the evidence. Aside from a few references in passing in his book Abendländische Eschatologie, translated recently as Occidental Eschatology, which recall that for Barth, revelation is not a predicate of history, but history is a predicate of revelation, this diagnosis is further elaborated in a series of essays published in the American Journal of Theology in 1954 and republished in Taubes's From Cult to Culture, and entitled Dialectic and Analogy, the first essay, and Theology and Theology, a Philosophical Analysis of Karl Barth's Dialectical Theology. Here, Taubes makes several observations relevant to our purposes, albeit in terms that seem always slightly off or imprecise.
as was his rhetorical style. The following invective, for example, made only in passing, is illustrative in this respect. Here's Taubes in one of these essays. What today is not theology, apart from theological chatter, geschwätz, is Ernst Jünger less theology than Rudolf Bultmann or Emil Brunner, the two main other representatives of dialectical theology in the early phase? Franz Kafka less than Karl Barth, end of quote. Barth theology then, at least in the period of the second fully revised 1922 edition of the Römerbrief, is said to completely subvert scholastic and Thomist philosophy and all so-called natural theology, based as these remain upon the principle of the analogia entis, the analogy of being, and what Taubes calls the, quote, double bookkeeping of the so-called duplex ordo. But replaces the presumed hierarchical order of things and the chain of being with an altogether different model. As the theology, here's Taubes on Barth, as the theology of actualism, actualismus, dialectical theology contradicts the Thomistic philosophy and theology on the basic notion of being. The symbols of creation, sin, and redemption are not interpreted in the pattern of natural, supernatural, but in a temporal, trans-historical scheme. Its categories are not the unfolding of nature of the nature of things, but the unfolding of a sequence of events, Ereignisse. Only such an ontological philosophy would be adequate to express the basic schema of dialectical theology that could develop the temporal structure of its categories, most probably Henri Bergson's or Heidegger's anti-Aristotelian philosophy would provide the epistemological and ontological foundation of Barth's historical categories as a kind of eventlessness, Ereignislosigkeit, or in a contradictory move, as the English published version had it, as a logic of events. And yet, in spite of this suggestive comparison, the comparison with Bergson and Heidegger, Barth's theological universe seems eons removed from the philosophies of a Bergson and a Heidegger, who, by the way, are in different ways neither anti-Aristotelian nor quite on the same page with Barth on much else either. Nor does Barth's thought strike one as being based on a, quote, basic notion of being, end of quote. Moreover, if actualism is really the term one wants to invoke here, then it's hard to see how this would sit well with either eventlessness or any logic, for that matter. This said, Taubes is certainly right to comment that Barth may very well have written an altogether new chapter in the history of dialectics. That is to say, in the very history of method and ontology that Heidegger claims in Being and Time, Aristotle himself had already overcome in its Platonic variety, and that Heidegger in turn dismisses in its Hegelian expansion as well. In other words, Barth, so Taubes, would have offered a theology without theodicy, thus opening the possibility of a religious language in an age of the eclipse of the divine. The language of dialectical theology seems able to absorb even the atheism of Nietzsche and Franz Overbeck as stages in the purification of man's image of God, and could accept the realm of necessity as a veil of the divine. Karl Barth opened a gate to a trans-theistic stage of consciousness, but he opened the gate to this stage as a theologian, end of quote. Taubes quickly gives in to the temptation to read these general statements as a specimen, not just of political theology, as he claims throughout, but of political Marcionism or of a political demonology premised upon the doctrine of an alien god, as von Hanack had interpreted the early Christian heresy with unveiled sympathy. In Barth's and Taubes' hands, it undermines the cultural symbiosis and complacency of liberal Protestantism, and hence anticipates the very crisis out of which Barth's, Friedrich Gogarten's, Emil Brunner's, Rudolf Bultmann's dialectical theology would consequently emerge. And yet, dialectical theology, somewhat like the inverse or other theology about which I will say more now, engages the order and powers that be, including the events that inevitably come to interrupt them, in ways that are more hesitant and paradoxical than the dualisms of Marcionism, old and new, political and or aesthetic, and together with the so-called antinomianism of all stripes, antinomianism being one of Taubes' favorite notions. An altogether different explanatory model, an alternative messianic logic, if you like, seems thus to be called for. Instead of an ontological dualism, what is at play here, it would seem, is rather an ontological, theological prioritization, an inverted hierarchy, as it were, a novel optics of aspects of the absolute, as opposed to merely relative, and hence ultimately unimportant, sinful, and dying values, under whose gaze all things can be seen and set aright, creation and revelation, history and its fall, messianic redemption, and the restitution of all in all. The restitutio in integrum, in which the origin, the ursprung, as Barth has it, call it the paradisical state and atomistic language, is once again the aim. Taubes summarizes things aptly when he sides with Barth, as with Benjamin and Kafka, as we will see, against Adorno, whom he somewhat unfairly again accuses of reducing the messianic optics to a mere idea, and eventually to the purely aesthetic as if. If God is God, this is Taubes, summarizing the dialectical theology of Karl Barth as formulated in the commentary on the letter to the Romans. If God is God, then he can't be coaxed out of our soul. There is a prius here, an a priori. Something has to happen from the other side. Then we see when our eyes are pierced open. Otherwise, we see nothing. Otherwise, we ascend, we strive until the day after tomorrow. End of quote. To put things differently and apodictically, adopting a formulation used by Bruce McCormack in his big commentary on Karl Barth, and supposedly undermining all fictionalism, every reduction of redemption to a mere as if, a mere comme si, of what would be better for us to believe, as a mere hypothetical, as it were. If God is God, then he must not be, McCormack suggests, then he must not be a possible God, but the God who is. In other words, neither an anatheistic God who may be, nor a speculative, materialist, inexistent, and virtual God must still be produced, but a critically realist, and in that sense precisely dialectical conception of God, who is what he is and what he will be, is in place in Barth's commentary. And a crucial question here remains, of course. After all, is what we call God, God? Or is the phrase, if God is God, much more than an empty, near formal tautology whose formulation and formalization, if A then A, or A equals A, can yield no content or meaning or force worthy of the name, of the divine name, that is. Karabakh's probing meditation on Anselmus, and notably on the so-called ontological argument for the existence of God, published in 1931 under the title Fides Quaerens Intellectum, and often described as Barthes' Discours de la Méthode, offers somewhat of a response to these questions. And interestingly, other than Tauber's suspects, Adorno's own dictum that all philosophy revolves around our understanding and giving of the ontological proof for the existence of God, even after Kant had destroyed it, is another. Now, as my title indicated, I would like, in the final part of my talk, to limit myself and venture an hypothesis regarding Barthes and Adorno in particular, helped by a concept, a rather enigmatic formula, namely that of an inverse theology, inverse theologie. A concept that the latter, Adorno, first uses in his correspondence with Benjamin, discussing the reception of Franz Kafka's writings in particular. But then a concept that he also gave a much broader relevance in his later conversations with Max Horkheimer, speaking now of the other theology, the andere theologie, more abstractly. So inverse theology and the other theology, asking ourselves what marks the distinction between the theology of the other, that is Karl Barth's dialectical theology in uneasy proximity to Marcion's alien god. It is in the latter broader use of the idea of an other theology, and by implication also in the earlier inverse theology motif, without which I think the latter cannot be understood. It's that conception that I believe still concerns us today, even though its theoretical premises and practical assumptions, especially in their presumed contrast with the dialectical and, as some have said, neo-orthodox theology of the Holy Other that Barthes inaugurated. It's this complex that merits closer scrutiny and, I think, if I'm not mistaken, stands in need of drastic reformulation. And this for two reasons at least. First of all, because in its earliest formulation, the putative contrast between the idea of an inverse or other theology and that of dialectical theology is not at all that clear. Just how, one should ask, does Adorno's idea of an inverse or other theology relate to the need for a wholly other theological foundation that Thurneisen suggested to Barthes in their weekly correspondence when both were pastors in adjacent villages and about to initiate the revolution in Protestant thought? In other words, how exactly does one differentiate between the other theology, the andere theologie, and the theology of the holy other, of das ganz andere, given that their respective object or subject is precisely absolute, indeed the absolute, and hence absolves itself from every conceptual determination, from every divine nomination, from every image or picture, all of which Barthes and Adorno will insist risk blasphemy and idolatry as they reach beyond the tangential, infinitesimal, and disappearing fleeting point upon which they touch, if only vainly. And second, I think it's important to return to this distinction and early debate between Adorno and Barthes, because a fateful development and painful consequence has imposed itself on the notion of inverse or other theology, one that would ultimately find one of its most influential, in any case far more widely discussed expressions, in the later Max Horkheimer's Sehnsucht nach dem ganz anderen, the desire, the longing for the totally other. A famous interview that he gave in 1970 to Der Spiegel, the major German periodical. And it makes all too clear that the semantic and political force of its concept seemed at that time all but lost. Horkheimer's later thought has been subject of an increasingly recent study by Pascal Eitler on the politicization of religion in Germany during the late 60s. And I think it deserves fuller attention in this context than I can now give it. But my hypothesis is that the misinterpretation or the running out of steam of the other theology, of the inverse theology, explains precisely why especially the second generation of the Frankfurt School moved beyond its evident impasses, as it's found precisely in Horkheimer's later writings, thereby obfuscating a much more interesting and necessary debate early on in the contrast between inverse and dialectical theology. Horkheimer, and in this fully consistent with the negative Schopenhauerianism of his early essays, would reduce to a simple impasse what in Adorno and Barth, coming from different angles, but converging and intersecting, however tangentially, in a single and minimal point, was somehow dialectically and paradoxically, and indeed rhetorically, forged and kept together, thus inviting philosophy and theology in their respective views, autonomous and dogmatic thinking, to enter a new constellation and conversation that each, to its own detriment, and merely speaking on its own term, had seemed to avoid. The term inverse theology appears in a letter, as I said, to Benjamin, dated December 17, 1934, in which Adorno reports on his readings of Kafka, whose later somewhat elaborate documentation we find in the Aufzeichnungen zu Kafka, the Notes on Kafka, first published in 1953, in the Neue Rundschau, and then reprinted in 1955 in Prismen. It is in this text that we find the most extensive indications as to what Adorno's, and we are led to believe Kafka's own conception of an inverse, as opposed to, say, straight or rather dialectical, more in particular Christian dogmatic, and, as it turns out, Jewish national theology might mean, both in light of a general and specific presuppositions and orientations, be they aesthetic or existential, political or religious. For all we know, Adorno suggests, inverse theology may call for the representation of something altogether different and unheard of, something not of this world, but for that very reason, not otherworldly per se, something not of this world, but for that very reason, not otherworldly per se. Yet the concept and deeper motivation had been long in preparation in Adorno's own writings, just as they cast a long shadow well beyond the interpretation of Kafka in this context. We find echoes of inverse theology in the essays that Adorno devoted to Arnold Schoenberg's Moses und Aaron, in his reading of Beckett's Endgame, and also in the recently published series of lectures courses that led up to the actual publication of Adorno's magnum opus, The Negative Dialectics, in 1966. Interestingly, in contesting a certain, but not necessarily every theological interpretation of Kafka's overall oeuvre, namely the one that describes this author in terms of a religious position, perhaps even the religious archy position as such, Adorno takes issue here not so much with Barth, or, as one might have expected, with Max Brod, who, after all, was the main proponent of the Jewish theological interpretation of the literary legacy that had been entrusted to him directly, but Adorno takes to task Hans-Joachim Schöps. It's Adorno's interview. This I could not. Okay. But and brood are mentioned in passing. Yet it is Schupp's appropriation of what Adorno calls dialectical theology here. More in particular, it is Schupp's interpretation of Kafka in terms of a Barthianism without mediator, Barthianismus ohne Mittler. That is to say, without Christ, or for that matter, any other intermediary instance or connecting instant, bridging, however tangentially, heaven and earth. That provokes Adorno's ire and dismissive gesture. Schupp had sent his 1931 Jüdische Glaube in diese Zeit, Jewish faith in this age, subtitled Prolegomena zu einer Grundlegung einer systematischen Theologie des Judentums, the Prolegomena for a foundation of systematic theology of Judaism. Schupp had sent this book to Barth, and he had met him in person as well. A correspondence in which Barth responded critically to Schupp's thesis followed roughly a year later. And yet, if Schupp is somewhat apologetic in choosing these words, Barthianism without a mediator, Barthianismus ohne Mittler, or in the plural, without mediators, which Mittler indicates as well, then this hesitancy concerns precisely the very choice of these words. If we want to typify, Schupp says, Kafka's worldview, then it is sit venia verbo, may there be forgiveness for the word, a Barthianism without mediator or without mediators. Not only the path from earth to heaven, but also the one from heaven to earth is too long to ever be followed. End of quote. Adorno's reservations against dialectical theology, then, must be directed not so much against Barth, but against a certain interpretation of Barth, namely the one by Schupp. They seem aimed not so much at the theology of the entirely other, the theology laid out in the letter, in the commentary on the letter to the Romans, a theology that he takes to task elsewhere, but never quite convincingly. Indeed, his de facto target is the afterword to the posthumous edition of Kafka's Beim Bau der Chinesischen Mauer, The Building of the Great Wall of China, published by Schupp together with Max Brod in 1931, which announced a forthcoming monograph in which Schupp would seek to present a detailed interpretation of Kafka's entire work as ultimately expressing a negative actualization of the Judaic understanding of revelation, and one conditioned by the advancing process of secularization, end of quote. This phrase, negative actualization, negative actualisierung, is deeply puzzling and downright paradoxical. After all, is a negative actualization not precisely an active deactualization of sorts? Or is a negative actualization of the Judaic understanding of the revelation a de facto Christian understanding of that very same revelation, and one that is brought about, but one wonders how exactly, by, quote, the advancing process of secularization? This suggestion, I suspect, is precisely what may have troubled Gershom Scholem in his open letter to Schupp, in which he categorically but politely rejected this author's position in his main work, Jüdische Glaube in dieser Zeit, and protests against the letter's abundant and uncritical use of, quote, Protestant terminology. This much is clear though. Schupp claims that for Kafka, the human soul needs a mediator or a series of mediators, and that without such mediation, transcendence remains final and our distance from it without hope. The path to the next human heart, even the road between heaven and earth, as well as the one that leads back from heaven to from earth to heaven, is otherwise simply too long to ever to be followed. Revelation may be given, and indeed may be continually given. And Schupp cites a fragment which goes as follows through the words. Through the words remains of light transpire. Quer durch die Worte kommen Reste von Licht. But an ultimate and fuller redemption, nonetheless, ever fails to arrive. The miracle, the wonder of God's unfathomable act of love then, which alone is capable of bridging the gap, of crossing the bridge, has in Kafka's eyes, in his worldview, Schöps claims, simply not happened. His Barthianism then remains without mediation, without a mediator, without mediators. There is the absolute, no doubt, call it an infinity of access to infinite hope, but none of it quite accessible to us. Just as conversely, nothing in and of heaven finds its way back to earth, if ever it got there in the first place. And still one wonders what a Barthianism without mediator could possibly mean, since for Barth, the theological concept of revelation remains centrally tied to the figure of Christ, that is, to the positive actualization of revelation, so to speak, and more precisely, to his resurrection, which in Barth's view, everything but a worldview, come to think of it, is the sole instance, the single word that puts all powers, all gods, all of history, every culture, each anthropology, including the natural theologies that have built upon them, to shame, once and for all, rendering them all nil, nothing less, nothing more. And this is Barth, and I'm going to cut to my conclusion. The gospel of the resurrection is the power of God, his virtus, the disclosing and apprehending of his meaning, his effective preeminence over all gods. It is the action, the supreme miracle, wunder alle wunder, by which God, the unknown God dwelling in light unapproachable, the Holy One, Creator and Redeemer, makes himself known. What therefore ye worship in ignorance, this I set forth unto you. No divinities remaining on this side of the line of resurrection, no divinity which dwells in temples made of with hand, or which is served by the hands of man. No divinities that need anyone, that is to say, any human being that pretends to know them, can be God. God is the unknown, and precisely as such he bestows life and breath and all things. Therefore, the power of God can be detected neither in the world of nature nor in the souls of men. It must not be confounded with any high exalted force, known or noble. The power of God is the most exalted of forces, nor is it either their sum or their fount, but the crisis of all powers, the totally different, das ganz andere, that by which all power is measured and by which it is pronounced to be both something and nothing, nothing and something. So the power of God stands neither at the side of nor above the limited and limiting powers, not to be confused with them, not to be ranged among them. It can, save with the greatest caution, be compared with them. The power of God, the instauration of Jesus as the Christ, is in the strictest sense of the word a presupposition, free from any content that can be grasped. Note that the reference to the unknown God is also taken as a point of departure by von Hanack, who suggests that Marcion developed this notion from an eventual God to that of a radically alien God, thus departing precisely from the Hellenizing and Gnostic tendencies of his time, which Paul, as is testified with the Acts of the Apostles, in the well-known scene on the Areopagus, confronted head-on. Note also that the idea and introduction of an absolutely presuppositionless assumption or instauration is an eminently phenomenological operation that brings Barth, like Benjamin, in the vicinity of Edmund Husserl, whose concept of the phenomenologically originally given, together with the so-called reduction and neutralization of all natural dispositions, with which it shows remarkable parallels. And yet, this is not all. Paradoxically, Schöps goes on to suggest Kafka's deepest insight and most profound unrest might be much closer to the Christian truth than any faith of the nominally devout Christians, who strangely and often all too quickly assume and accept salvation on their own behalf first, and that of others second. Moreover, such a truth, had it been taken to heart, would do greater justice to the disturbing fact that on this, and perhaps Kafka's own view, also the position of heaven vis-a-vis earth remains fundamentally off, that is to say, crooked and warped, geometrically put wind sheaf, just as the relationship between God and man retains an element of oppressing uncertainty. And yet to say and experience as much, Schuppes intimates, is the original, authentic, and ultimate religious disposition. It is the religious arch position as such. I conclude. Adorno, as one might believe, is not so far removed at all from these assumptions. What then does it mean to speak of inverse theology? To speak of theology in terms of inversion or otherness risks, on Adorno's view, tying religion back to a putative past that, for all we know, may not be behind us after all, or of collapsing into some immeasurable ephemeral quality that must go unnamed, whether for now and indefinitely or forever. The inverse and other theology, as Adorno understands it, cannot be the dialectical or, as McCormack puts it, the critically realistic theology that Barth had pursued from his first commentary on Paul's letter to the Romans onwards. Nor can it come near anywhere the argument, if that's what we should call it, propounded by the later Max Horkheimer in his interview on Die Sehnsucht nach dem ganz anderen, the longing for the totally other. Neither Adorno nor Barth think of the totally other, however, as a mere abstract, negative metaphysical, and hence merely noumenal counterpoint to the phenomenal world as we find it. We saw that for Barth it's the miracle of faith, and for Adorno it is the immediacy to which even a resolute negative dialectics, proceeding through determinate negation and respecting the prohibition of images, of all images, well beyond of what this built for both originally intended, remains answerable and deep down attuned. More than a thought then, and perhaps than an afterthought, that merely reacts against the enclosing imminence of the totally regulated and administered world, Adorno's negative dialectic, and especially the form it takes in his later writings as a meditation, a contemplation, even spiritual experience, geistige Erfahrung, follows this trace of the other, this Spur des Anderen. It follows it into the most material and corporeal experiences of qualitative instances and instants, whose minimal difference may yet make maximal difference in the world, inviting, demanding, and forcing its total recall and its total makeover, nothing less. By the same token, Barth's miracle of faith and the miracle of revelation, of God's word and of God speaking, concerns a proclamation that, for all its ambiguous and hence contestable, even revocable nature, remains to be heard and obeyed, and likewise leaves nothing untouched. Neither model, the materialist or the ecclesial, the minimal and maximal theological optics that I have described here, however, succeeds in demarcating itself fully from what seemed its clearest opposite. In fact, I would claim, they find a common agreement in distancing themselves from the gratuitous gesture of all appeals that take that which is other than what exists as a mere idea, however critical, but too good to ring true. The comme si affaire, the as if perspective, or, as I would be tempted to call it, the dual aspect seeing of negative dialectics and its spiritual exercise, is therefore everything but resigned aestheticism, the aestheticism of which Taubes unjustly accuses Adorno. And as it touches upon the aesthetics, and why should it not, in Adorno. It does so in Barth to no lesser extent. Put differently, if fundamental and merely meditative, contemplative aesthetic perspectives there are in Adorno's writing, they precisely resemble the very way in which Barth's own massive church dogmatics paints the whole universe from, quote, from the standpoint of God. In other words, the massive differences in point of departure, not to mention that of putative destinies in their overall oeuvre, cannot hide the fact that for their respective and eminently modern and 20th century sensibilities, the vocabularies and concepts, rhetoric and pragmatics of religion can no longer be kept at bay, just as it can no longer be kept apart from the philosophical discourses that accompany, enable, and even criticize it. Critical theory and dogmatic theology, therefore, in this historical phase, referred to each other and continued to do so, for all the reasons given. That the result is not necessarily conformism or apologetics, naturalism or supernaturalism, indicates that the front lines between philosophy and theology, reason and revelation, knowledge and faith, run no longer between secular modernity and a supposedly traditional, if increasingly public and global religion, but through each of these domains individually, in any case, elsewhere, and often where we expect them the least. Thank you.